Alan, I'm the Chief Judge at Common Law, for those who don't know, in New South Wales. I was, with every respect to Nye, I was very interested to hear a federal court judge talking about sentencing in New South Wales. We now move to the next session devoted to three speakers with three separate topics emerging from recent cases. Rachel Pepper, firstly, Sarah Murray and Jeremy Gans. Each of them has been given a discrete area to talk about. Can I just say, in relation to Rachel's paper, as I mentioned to her a moment ago, in 1984 I was retained by South Australia to pursue litigation against Victoria and New South Wales over water. And we were about to launch ourselves into the High Court when the politicians intervened. The New South Wales politician was Paul Lander, who not long after he intervened died. One can perhaps see a continuum of the litigious process which started way back in 1984. Sarah Murray is going to talk about elections and Jeremy Gans about crime. I'm not going to say anything more about any of them, but leave them to allocate and sort out the time in the hope that we'll have questions at the end. But first of all, Rachel Pepper.
Australia is the driest inhabited continent on the planet. It has the lowest average and most variable rainfall, the lowest level of river discharge and the most variable stream flow, the lowest amount of runoff and the smallest area of permanent wetlands in the world. Now, against these inviolable facts is the inevitability of ever-increasing water consumption caused by an ever-increasing population. Development generates demand for water. Now, agricultural development is particularly thirsty. In 2000-2001, over two-thirds of water consumed in Australia was used for agricultural irrigation. Well, tragically, however, public maladministration since colonialization has resulted in a flagrant misuse and overallocation of water resources to such an extent that entire river systems are on the verge of collapse. In large measure, blame may be attributed to the constitutional underpinnings governing the use of water within Australia, which have promoted, in my view, national interest to flourish. Driven, no doubt, by an increasingly urgent need for remedial action, the Commonwealth has sought to intervene in both the interstate and intrastate arrangements with respect to the access and allocation of water. This intervention has caused tension, particularly in circumstances where the result has been a perceived diminution of rights previously held. The consequence has been that these arrangements, until now largely ignored by constitutional lawyers, are now the subject of close scrutiny. Water rights have become hot constitutional property. And it's in this context that I wish to discuss a triumvirate of cases commencing with ICM Agriculture in the Commonwealth, continuing with Arnold and the Minister, and concluding with Spencer in the Commonwealth. But in order to understand, I think, how water rights have become constitutionalized, I think we need to have a brief examination of the Australian ownership of water. Now, upon first settlement of Australia, the title to all waters was vested in the British Crown. This was because, or at least so the pre-Mabo fiction tells us, all private rights, rights to land, which included rights of access to water, could only be obtained by a grant from the Crown. Well, initially, governors granted rights to the Crown of waste or unsettled lands, which included water, upon permission from the imperial government. As the colonies obtained powers of responsible self-government, they sought control of these unsettled lands, and including control of the water. This was achieved by imperial legislation conferring self-government on the various colonial legislatures, which included the management and control of wastelands and the waters upon them. Now, concomitant with this conferral was the power to regulate and acquire what was now quite lucrative revenue arising from these so-called wastelands. It was these colonial arrangements that governed access to water at the time of federation. Now, who should have power to regulate access to state waters, or more specifically rivers, and in particular the Murray River, transformed into what was described as a monstrously long and tangled debate in the convention debates? Now, Section 100, as you know, is the only provision that expressly mentions water in the Constitution. Well, this is no accident. Initially, Section 100 was fashioned to confer positive legislative authority upon the Commonwealth Parliament in respect of the control and regulation of navigable streams and their tributaries within the Commonwealth and the use of waters thereof. Now, compare that version with the present version, which reads, "The Commonwealth shall not, by any law or regulation of trade or commerce, abridge the rights of a state or the residents therein to the reasonable use of the waters of rivers for conservation or irrigation." Now, how did this drafting change come about? Ultimately, it was the price to be paid for the birth of Federation. The compromise to preserve the separate interests of New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia, the former of which wanted to control access to water for the purposes of agricultural development, and the latter of which who wanted to ensure that access to trade in the east by the means of navigation continued. While agreement was accommodated between the Commonwealth and states, which led ultimately to the creation of sections 98 and 100 of the Constitution, I think it's fair to say that the interstate dispute about water rights was never really settled. It's a dispute that has endured from colonial settlement and informs present-day constitutional arrangements. The present-day constitutional arrangements are over state waters, other than those contained in the Constitution, are found in the Seas and Submerged Lands Act of 1973, which I don't wish to dwell on, other than to say that that act was held to be constitutionally valid in the Seas and Submerged Lands case. Now, the ambit of Section 14, and of course Section 14 of that act is the one that preserves, at least if read literally, state control over the waters of seas that are, state control over waters that are waters within any bay, gulf, estuary, river, creek, inlet, port, or harbour, which were upon federation within the limits of the state. As I said, the ambit of Section 14 has not been authoritatively determined, and therefore the precise waters falling within the limits of the colonies as at 1 January 1901, and therefore the legislative powers of the states today in relation to those waters remains uncertain. Well, turning then to the power of the Commonwealth contained in the Constitution to regulate state water, as I said, there is no direct power over state water at the Commonwealth level. But this does not mean that there is an absence, a complete federal legislative lacuna in this regard. There are a number of heads of powers permitting the Commonwealth to enact legislation to manage water. Section 51.1, Trade and Commerce. Section 51.2, Taxation, provided it's non-discriminatory. Section 51.20, Corporations Power. Section 51.29, External Affairs Power. Section 51.39, the Incidental Power. Section 61, the Executive Power. An implied Nationhood Power. Section 81, together with Section 83, Appropriations Power. Section 96, the power to provide grants and financial assistance. And Section 122, the Territory's Power. Now, for today's purposes, I'm going to wholly ignore the taxation power and the territory's power, largely ignore the external affairs power, the corporation's power, and the joint and several effect of the executive, incidental, and implied nationhood powers, and focus instead, I think, on the more fiscal aspects of the constitutional regulation of internal water. I suspect that because of the absence of any direct power over internal water at a Commonwealth level, and due to uncertainties as to the ambit of other heads of power to regulate this resource, overwhelmingly access to and use of water within Australia is managed by the Commonwealth with the constitutional carrot and stick of tied grants and the provision of financial assistance to the states on terms. Now, the Commonwealth is empowered by Section 96 to grant financial assistance to the states on such conditions as it thinks fit. It also has the ability to provide funds through its appropriations power in Section 81. Now, this financial assistance has traditionally included three forms. First, direct grants by the Commonwealth to a state for specific projects within a state. Typically, the grants legislation deals with the financial assistance, while authority for the implementation of the project is a matter for state law. Second, ministerially approved financial assistance for specified projects. And third, statutory approval of assistance pursuant to an agreement between the Commonwealth and the state in relation to a particular project. Now, the orthodox view, until relatively recently, had been that the Commonwealth's discretion to exercise its funding and appropriation powers was broad. I think after the decisions in Combe and Pape, this view can no longer be maintained. Accordingly, if, for example, an appropriation was made for investing in water infrastructure, such as the building of a new sewage system for the purpose of generating recycled water, Commonwealth expenditure on a water infrastructure project that did not achieve this outcome, such as the building of a new dam, may well find itself to be invalid. Now, in PAPE, the plaintiff sued the Commissioner of Taxation in the Commonwealth, claiming that the tax bonus under Commonwealth legislation was invalid because it was a gift, because it was not law with respect to taxation under Section 51(2) or any other source of legislative power, and it did not comply with Sections 81 and 83 because it did not lawfully appropriate money for the purposes of the Commonwealth. Now, the High Court relevantly held that Sections 81 and 83 did not confer a substantive spending power in respect of anything that the Parliament designated as a purpose of the Commonwealth. Accordingly, the Act could not be supported by that power. The Act was, however, supported by Sections 61 and 51(39) of the Constitution as a law that was incidental to an exercise of executive power. Now, this was because of the extraordinary circumstances in which the legislation was passed, namely the midst of a financial crisis, global financial crisis, requiring immediate fiscal stimulus to the economy. This was a matter that was plainly concerning Australia as a nation. Now, also, I think, illustrated by PAPE, when combined with the incidental power in Section 51(39), the executive power in Section 61 can become a legislative power of the Commonwealth to engage in enterprises and activities peculiarly adapted to the government of a nation and which cannot otherwise be carried on for the benefit of a nation or the implied nationhood power. But again, I think the extent of this power, if it was ever certain, is certainly very uncertain after PAPE. While the learned authors of water resources law argue that there is potential to use this power given the pressing need to manage rivers and water basins across several states. Indeed, I think in Section 119 of the 2007 Water Act contains a specific reference to the implied power of Parliament to make laws with respect to nationhood. I do not share the optimism of the authors of that text given the reasoning and language in PAPE. The natural disaster that has befallen the Murray-Darling Basin, together with other morbidly compromised water systems in Australia, I think regrettably lacks the immediate and decisive urgency required to engage in the incidental and executive powers or the implied nationhood powers in this way. I'm reinforced in this view by the Tasmanian Dams case, where recourse to this head of power to support the Commonwealth legislation prohibiting the building of the dam was rejected. A potential fetter on the distribution of Commonwealth monies to fund projects designed to manage water resources within Australia is, of course, Section 51(31), which prohibits the acquisition of property on just terms from any state or person for any purposes, in respect to which the Parliament has power to make laws. States, by contrast, we know, may, subject to the laws of the state, acquire property on any terms. So Section 51(31), therefore, has no application to a state, or does it? In ICM, the plaintiffs, who were farmers, held licenses to extract groundwater, or bore licenses, under a 1912 Water Act. These licenses were replaced by a new system of aquifer access licenses under the 2000 Water Management Act, which was a state-based act in New South Wales. These new licenses substantially reduced, by up to 70%, the amount of water the plaintiffs were permitted to draw. The plaintiffs received some ex gratia payments for the reduction under a 2005 funding agreement between the Commonwealth and New South Wales that had established the new licenses. But, as was agreed by the parties, these payments were inadequate and in no way constituted compensation on just terms. Because the Commonwealth was a party to the funding agreement, the plaintiffs argued that their reduction in entitlements was a Commonwealth acquisition of property contrary to Section 51(31). The parties to the funding agreement were the Commonwealth, acting through the National Water Commission, and the State of New South Wales, acting through the Department of Natural Resources. The payments were to be shared equally by the Commonwealth and the State. The National Water Commission was established by the National Water Commission Act 2004, which was a Commonwealth piece of legislation, assisted with the implementation of a 2004 intergovernmental agreement known as the National Water Initiative. One of the key features of the initiative was to return currently over-allocated and overused water systems to environmentally sustainable levels. Now, Section 40 of the Commission Act established the Australian Water Fund account, which was a special account to, amongst other things, pay costs or obligations incurred by the Commonwealth in the performance of the Commission's function under the Commission Act. The account was specifically funded by a standing appropriation from the Consolidated Revenue Fund, pursuant to sections 81 and 83 of the Constitution. Now, it was the New South Wales Minister administering the Water Management Act, however, who in fact ordered that the water entitlements be reduced, not a Commonwealth Minister. Now, the Chief Justice and Justices Gummow and Crennan held that the legislative power of the Commonwealth conferred by Section 96, together with Section 5136, did not extend to the grant of financial assistance to a state on terms and conditions requiring the state to acquire property other than on just terms, contrary to Section 5131. Similarly, to the extent that Section 96 was qualified by Section 5131, an agreement to grant financial assistance, which could not be authorised by Section 96, could equally not be supported by Section 61 of the Constitution. To this extent, they accepted the plaintiff's case, and so too did Justice Hayden in his dissent. Their honours accepted that the limitations on Commonwealth legislative power could inform the consistency of the funding agreement with the Constitution. In so doing, they refused leave to reopen Magennis and affirm the reasoning of Chief Justice Latham, who rejected the proposition that a federal statute giving financial assistance to the states could not be a law with respect to the acquisition of property for the purposes of Section 5131. In this respect, there was no inconsistency between the reasoning in Magennis and the reasoning in Pye and Renshaw. In Pye, there had been a rejection of the argument that the exercise of power to grant financial assistance under Section 96 would be vitiated if shown to be for the purpose of inducing the state to exercise its powers of acquisition other than on just terms. Because Section 96 was silent as to purpose, their honours were able to reconcile the apparent inconsistency with the reasoning in Pye and the reasoning in Magennis. Now, significantly, as we shall see, their honours left deliberately open the question of whether grants of financial assistance pursuant to Section 96 of the Constitution, supported by informal arrangement between governments, such as exchanges of letters, negotiations, or email communications, which set out conditions to be observed in securing the financial assistance, which included an acquisition by the state of property on other than just terms, could be valid. Now, their honours went on to hold that the character of the bore licences precluded the application of Section 5131. This was because, while noting that water is a finite and fluctuating natural resource, first, the plaintiffs had no common law rights with respect to the extraction from the land of groundwater. The effect of the 1912 Water Act had been to extinguish whatever common law rights the plaintiffs had to appropriate this water. And second, while their honours did not decide whether the bore licences were of such an insubstantial character so as to be no more than an interest defeasible by operation of the legislation that called them into existence and therefore not constitutional property, they applied mutual pools and staff and held that there was no acquisition of property, merely an extinguishment, modification, or deprivation of rights which did not confer a measurable benefit or advantage on the state. This was because the plaintiffs did not enjoy private rights over the natural resources extracted. These rights had accrued in the state, and the state could exercise its powers to prohibit their access or use. Now, Justices Hayne, Kiefel, and Bell did not consider any of the issues concerning the intersection between Section 96 and Section 5131. Instead, their honours held that while the statutory basis of these fragile bore licences, particularly given their ability to be traded and used as security, did not necessarily preclude them from being a species of constitutional property. They did note that the water itself was not property given its replaceable but fugitive source. The plaintiff's entitlement was more in the form of a statutory dispensation from a general prohibition against the taking of groundwater rather than conferring any positive right to do so. There was no acquisition of property because no party had, as was required, derived an identifiable and measurable advantage or benefit in the reduction of the water allocation. The cancellation and replacement of the bore licences and the commensurate increase in the groundwater did not give the state any new, larger, or enhanced interest in the property. Now, in dissent, Justice Hayden agreed that the plaintiffs had no common law rights to take the groundwater, but His Honour found that the bore licences did amount to property in the constitutional sense. Landowners had paid money for them. The licences were transferable. A security interest could be given over them. They were included in assessing land values. With the greatest of respect, I confess that I find Justice Hayden's conclusions in this regard quite compelling. Now, in relation to the question of whether there had been an acquisition, His Honour held that there had, because the state received an advantage upon the reduction of the plaintiff's proprietary rights. In that, it was relieved of its obligation under the bore licences to ensure that the plaintiffs received their allocated share of groundwater. Accordingly, Justice Hayden found that there had been an acquisition of property other than on just terms, and that the Commission Act and the funding agreement were both invalid. I think, in summary, what emerges from ICM is the following. First, the provision of tied financial assistance by the Commonwealth to the states attracts the operation of Section 5131 and cannot be used as a device to circumvent the operation of the Constitution. Second, that whether statutorily created licences permitting the extraction of natural resources are a species of constitutional property is an open question and depends on their legislative characteristics. Third, there will be no acquisition absent any identifiable or measurable benefit or advantage conferred by an intergovernmental funding arrangement. And fourth, funding pursuant to Section 96 of the Constitution, supported by informal arrangements between governments, which include, by way of condition, the acquisition of the state by the state of property other than on just terms, may also be invalid pursuant to Section 5131. Now, the reasoning in ICM, at least in relation to Section 5131, was affirmed and adopted, I think, 2 months later only, in the almost factually identical decision in Arnold, to which I'll return shortly. In Spencer, the Commonwealth brought a motion under Section 31, capital A, subsection 2 of the Federal Court Act, seeking dismissal of Mr. Spencer's proceedings on the basis that he had no reasonable prospects of success. The facts in Spencer were similar to those in ICM and Arnold, but rather than restrictions on groundwater extraction, it was asserted by the applicant there that by operation of a suite of federal enactments and intergovernmental agreements between the Commonwealth and New South Wales, resultant state legislation restricted his ability to clear native vegetation on his farm and constituted a constitutionally invalid acquisition of his property. Now, the judge at first instance upheld the motion to dismiss. On appeal, in dismissing the appeal, the full court of the Federal Court relied on the decision in Pye and Renshaw, relied on the decision of the New South Wales Court of Appeal in Arnold and the Minister, which at that time was relevantly indistinguishable, and the applicant's acceptance of the validity of state legislation, which meant that even if the Commonwealth legislation and intergovernmental agreements were invalid, the state legislation would continue in force as the source of the prohibitions and restrictions complained of. The decision in the full court, it must be remembered, was handed down prior to the High Court deciding either ICM or Arnold. Well, in the High Court, the Chief Justice and Justice Gummow, with whom the other judges agreed, first discussed the history and scope of Section 31A, which for present purposes I won't go into. Their honours then went on to conclude that because ICM had left open the question of whether an informal arrangement between the Commonwealth and the state conditioning funding to be provided on the acquisition of property other than on just terms could be or could not be valid under Section 5131, and because the applicant's pleadings left open this possibility, thereby requiring factual exploration and possible amendment, his case was not one which had no reasonable prospects of success and should not have been dismissed. So much for precedent. Well, what about the fact that water is a commodity which is priced and traded like any other commercial asset? Given this commercialization, can the Commonwealth regulate the use of state water under the trade and commerce power or under the corporation's power? Well, turning first to the trade and commerce power in Section 51.1, how far back beyond mere prescription of standards for export the parliamentary power conferred by Section 51 extends is an unanswered question. In O'Sullivan and Orlunga, Justice Fuligar stated that Section 51 could enter the factory or the field or the mine. Well, if it can enter the mine, then presumably it can wade into the river, but perhaps not. In Murphy Orr's, the court determined that the direct operation of the law in question was to prohibit the export of a commodity from Australia and not, as it appeared on the face of the legislation, a law directed to halt sand mining on Fraser Island. Thus, its validity under Section 51.1 was upheld. However, Justice Mason explicitly opined that the Commonwealth law would have exceeded the powers of the Commonwealth if this had been its subject matter. That the Commonwealth can, of course, use this head of power to regulate the interstate water market is probably an unremarkable proposition today, and one of which supports some of the water trading rules in Parts 2 and 3 of the 2007 Water Act. Less certain, however, is the extent to which Section 51.1 may be used even in an incidental capacity to regulate activities of intrastate trade. For example, could this head of power be used to control the quantity of water used to irrigate crops only a limited, very limited proportion of which was ultimately to be consumed overseas or interstate. This somewhat artificial quarantining of the intrastate trade and commerce from this head of power, particularly given the complexity of modern commercial transactions, has meant that it has had limited scope in the promulgation of national economic policies directed towards water protection. A further complication is the apparent restriction contained in Section 100 of the Constitution. Until Arnold, Section 100 had not been the subject of extensive judicial scrutiny. Well, is the provision a limitation or a guarantee? Do the words any law or regulation of trade and commerce include not only Section 51(1) but also the corporation's power in Section 51(20)? In Morgan and the Commonwealth, the High Court confined the reference to the laws of trade and commerce contained in Sections 98 to 102 to Section 51(1). And Morgan was followed in the Tasmanian Dams case. However, in that case, Justice Mason expressly acknowledged the artificiality of the narrow approach in Morgan, which permitted the Commonwealth to achieve, by recourse to other legislative powers, that which was verboten under Section 100. The explanation he gave was a historical one, namely that Section 100 was an expression of the economic importance of, in particular, the Murray River to New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia, at the time of federation. Well, the Commission Act and the National Water Initiative Act, which we saw in ICM, were again the subject of scrutiny in Arnold. Indeed, the facts underpinning that decision are relevantly identical to those in ICM. Now, in Arnold, the appellants challenged the replacement licenses on a number of grounds, including two constitutional grounds. First, that the replacement licenses constituted an acquisition of property, contrary to Section 5131, and second, that the funding agreement was a regulation of trade or commerce that contravened Section 100. Now, the first issue was quickly dispensed with by the majority, Justice Hayden, of course, in dissent, by applying the reasoning in ICM. Now, the challenge based on Section 100 of the Constitution also failed. The majority held that it was clear from the drafting history of the Constitution that Section 100 was directed to limiting the Commonwealth's powers in respect of Sections 51(1) and Section 98 of the Constitution. The majority held, relying in particular on Quick and Garran's commentary in relation to Section 100, that the rights of the appellants said to have been abridged by the replacement of their bore licenses did not relate to the use of waters of rivers in Section 100, but related to underground water in aquifers only. Therefore, Section 100 had no application. Now, in my view, Arnold arguably raises more questions than it answered in relation to the reach of Section 100. For example, first, while the court refused to re-examine the correctness of Morgan, it also declined to endorse it. The Chief Justice specifically noted the artificiality of its consequences, adverted to by Justice Mason in the Dams case, and that they remained ever present. Second, the Chief Justice also noted that it would be difficult to see how an agreement made between the executive governments of the Commonwealth and the states could, of itself, ever constitute a law or regulation of trade and commerce. Third, there was an interesting question raised by the Chief Justice and Justices Gummo and Crennan, whether the term right of the residence in Section 100 was used in a collective sense or in an individual sense. Fourth, Justices Gummo and Crennan left open the question of whether, as between riparian states and their residents, Section 100 guarantees access to the use of waters for the purposes mentioned, or does no more than impose a restriction on the exercise of the power of the Commonwealth. And fifth, their honors queried whether the lakes and billabongs into which a river spreads in flood, very topical at present, is part of a river and thus included in the term the waters of rivers. One further issue which has not been tested to date is the extent to which the Commonwealth may pass a law which promotes an environmentally sustainable use of rivers on the basis that to do so would be to provide for the reasonable use of water. Put another way, can the Commonwealth pass a law that would, in effect, prohibit the unreasonable use of the waters of rivers for conservation? Now, very quickly, in relation to the corporation's power, as the Tasmanian Dams case demonstrated, few, if any, of the limitations exist with respect to the use of that power. Any lingering doubts to this effect were swept away in the work choices case. Well, finally, the external affairs power. To the detriment of the states, the considerable width of the Commonwealth's external affairs power, and Section 5129 was established in, again, the Dams case, and later reinforced in Victoria and the Commonwealth, otherwise known as the Industrial Relations case and other cases. But the external affairs power demands that any Commonwealth legislation be faithful and give effect to the terms of the international instrument Australia has agreed to implement. Parliament cannot, by recourse to Section 5129, simply legislate at will. The enacting statute must be reasonably appropriate and adapted to achieving the obligations under the convention or treaty. Now, given that there are presently no international treaties which specifically cover the conservation of water resources, this constraint may prove problematic. This may explain why the 2007 Commonwealth Water Act relies in part on no less than 8 international agreements for legitimacy. Well, in his recent book, The Water Dreamers, Michael Cathcart made the following observation. Water is the fundamental limit on how Australians live. It determines where we establish our cities, how we think about country, how we farm it, build on it, defend it, and dream about it. Though the country is dry, Australia has more water per person than any other continent. By that measure, we are not running short of water. Yet many rivers and catchments are in crisis. We are still getting it wrong. Now, as has been discussed above, one explanation of why we're still getting it wrong lies in the colonial hangover from which we still constitutionally suffer. Namely, that control over water rights remains the exclusive preserve of the states. The Constitution provides limited recourse to the federal government to regulate and replenish this vital resource. This is further compromised by the constitutional uncertainty that has been created by cases such as ICM, Spencer, and Arnold, which serve only to render the Constitution a less than satisfactory vehicle to administer an effective solution to the current crisis. As Professor George Williams, as ever, has pithily put it, once again, how we manage our scarce water resources is being held hostage by our 1901 Constitution. Thank you.
Sarah Murray.
I think it's probably fair to say that few constitutional law cases last year attracted quite as much publicity as the action brought by the two Get Up members in Roe. At a time when coverage of the federal election was swamping the news cycle, Roe was hurried onto the High Court list, and I think at one point was even described as one of the most exciting parts of the federal election campaign. This was probably because it was, as far as I know, and please someone correct me if I'm wrong, it was one of the few High Court cases, or constitutional cases at least, where a protester managed to clamber onto the High Court bench, thankfully before their honours actually entered the courtroom and sat down. He was wearing a Liberal T-shirt, not a Get Up T-shirt, I believe, and was, of course, promptly removed and charged. But my favourite bit was that he was reported as being ordered not to return to the High Court for at least one day, which I thought was no doubt just to keep the excitement going, you know. Look, the case of Roe addressed the constitutionality of reforms made to the Commonwealth Electoral Act back in 2006. And these amendments were, in fact, that same ill-fated enactment that included provisions on prisoner disenfranchisement that were struck down by a majority of the court in Roach. The provisions that the court looked at in Roe, though, brought about an earlier closing of the electoral roll and put the High Court, in determining their validity, in the effective position of influencing whether an extra 100,000 otherwise eligible persons would be able to cast their vote at the federal election. The relevant 2006 amendments meant that after the writs for the federal election had been issued, voters had until 8 p.m. on that issuing day to enrol as a new voter, and until 8 p.m. 3 working days after to transfer their enrolment. Obviously, being listed on the roll was a prerequisite to being able to vote, as well as being able to vote in the electoral division or state in which that voter resided. And what the amendments did was curtail what, since 1983, had been a statutory 7-day period after the issue of the writs for electoral enrolments and enrolment transfers. prior to then, prior to 1983, the closure issue had rarely arisen because, as I understand it from the judgment, there had been an established Commonwealth executive practice by which the election was announced some days before the electoral writs were actually issued. Relevantly, the plaintiffs, Shannon Rowe and Douglas Thompson, had failed to enrol or transfer their enrolment respectively within this shortened statutory period that was introduced in 2006. They argued that the provisions were unconstitutional in unreasonably denying them the opportunity to enrol and to vote. And this was also supported to some degree by evidence that was presented by the Commonwealth Deputy Electoral Commissioner to the effect that there were approximately 100,000 others in a similar situation to the plaintiffs. The defendants, which included the Electoral Commissioner and the Commonwealth, argued in response that the legislative reforms didn't disqualify the plaintiffs from voting. And even if they did, well, this was constitutionally defensible. This was on the basis that the legislation prevented electoral fraud, even prophylactically, and guaranteed the integrity of the electoral roll. It was argued that the Act did this by allowing the Electoral Commission sufficient time to ensure that the roll was accurate, but also to really encourage voters to try and get their electoral affairs in order before the calling of the election. The High Court found in favour of the plaintiffs and invalidated the roll closing provisions in time for the election. And a week later, with GetUp, in fact, again being successful in their federal court action, this case related to the use of e-signatures on their AusEnroll website. It was rather amusingly, I think, reported that despite the confusion that was brought about by the 2000 election result, that one of the few winners of the campaign actually seemed to be GetUp. But I think there was almost a bit of a collective pause in constitutional breath because once the result in Roe was known, and even though this was known at quite a breakneck speed, it did prompt a great deal of speculation about the likely reasoning the court was going to use, as well as how the court would split in coming to that decision. In fact, and being asked to provide a catchy title for this paper at a time when the verdict was known but the judgment hadn't been handed down, which is a little bit mean in a way, I was feeling a little bit stumped and almost a little bit like I'd sort of sneaked to the back of the cryptic crossword book and read the answer and filled in the squares and the clue without really being any more the wiser as to how that result actually came about. And in fact, in honour of this, I was almost tempted to call this paper something kind of crosswordy, like, I don't know, Roe gets up and opens the rolls. But I felt that the crossword cluey type reference would probably just get lost amongst its sort of evident stupidity. But anyway, look, ultimately, in the judgment that was handed down in December, it was a majority of four made up of Chief Justice French and Justice Crennan and a joint judgment of Justices Gummow and Bell that found the provisions unconstitutional. The effect of the majority's invalidation of these provisions was a reversion to the 1983 statutory seven-day grace period. The majority's findings of unconstitutionality were rejected by the majority across three separate judgments by Justices Hayne, Hayden and Kiefel. And it's interesting, I think, to look at this case in light of Roach, which was handed down in 2007. Since 2007, there has, of course, been the appointments of Chief Justice French and Justices Kiefel and Bell. And what we saw in Roach was Chief Justice French and Justice Bell joining the majority camp, while Justice Kiefel aligned with the Roach minority of Justices Hayden and Hayne. So what Roe really boiled down to was whether, in reducing the post-writ enrolment period, the 2006 reforms disqualified or disenfranchised people who were otherwise entitled from being able to vote. If so, it raised the question whether, within the Roach methodology, the disentitlement was for a substantial reason, which could be justified as reasonably appropriate and adapted to serve an end consistent or compatible with the system of government prescribed by the Constitution. whenever I say that, I always just, it makes me laugh, and thinking of all the incredibly complicated law student acronyms you get in exam papers when they try and abbreviate that into some 15-letter acronym. The case was therefore argued around the constitutional meaning of the phrase directly chosen by the people in section 7 and section 24 of the Constitution, and the degree to which it limited electoral legislation made pursuant to a range of legislative heads. Particularly it concerned how much legislative freedom is given to the Commonwealth Parliament to determine the specifics of the electoral process while still aligning with the constitutional imperative. So firstly, turning to the majority judgments. The majority judgments acknowledged that, unlike Roach, the electoral provisions did not directly remove a particular class of citizens from being able to vote. However, the practical effect of the provisions, even if it was only procedural, was to deny or disqualify otherwise eligible persons from casting their vote if they failed to comply with that statutory cut-off period. This meant that there needed to be a substantial reason to justify that impairment. And the majority were convinced that the impact on the franchise could not be justified and was disproportionate when put up against, firstly, the lack of evidence of electoral fraud, secondly, the Electoral Commission's declared ability to still be able to process the enrolments even within the previous statutory regime, and thirdly, the constitutional priority that was given to people participating in the electoral process by the Constitution, or what I think Justice Crennan referred to as the centrality of the franchise. Chief Justice French, like Chief Justice Gleeson in Roach, was also swayed by the fact that Parliament was effectively turning back the clock by this attenuation in this 7-day grace period that had previously been there. His Honour explained that while this wasn't constitutionalising an established voting mechanism, it did mean that a departure from long-standing practice could fall foul of the relevant constitutional imperative if what you could really say was lacking was a substantial justification for that very departure. Well, what about the minority? The minority judges, in affirming the constitutionality of the amendments, were significantly influenced by, firstly, what they saw as the constitutional indefensibility of asserting that Commonwealth legislation should ensure the widest possible participation in elections. And secondly, the fact that the plaintiffs had committed an offence in failing to comply with their legal obligation under the Commonwealth Electoral Act to enrol or transfer their enrolment within a 21-day period in the first place, you know, well before the election was announced in most cases, and were effectively demanding that they be able to continue to disobey the legislation. For Justices Hayne, Hayden and Kiefel, this made it difficult to assert that their ability to vote was compromised by the legislation when the temporal differences being fought over were so small. And when being out of time, the plaintiffs were really seen as the authors of their own misfortunes. I should say that the majority didn't deny that the plaintiffs had committed an offence against the Act in not enrolling or transferring within that 21-day period. However, this wasn't seen as decisive by the majority because of the fact that the Commonwealth Electoral Act provided that if you did go on to lodge your enrolment form, even if you were out of time, then you wouldn't be subject to a penalty. And so what this meant for judges like Justice Crennan was that the Act was really putting the civic right over the legal duty. For Justice Hayden, the plaintiff's constitutional assertions were almost Dennis DeNutto-esque, I think, in really lacking any constitutional basis. And he really saw them as what he described as self-pitying appeals by Australia's victims and shirtless hordes. It's descamisados. His judgment definitely makes for an entertaining read, and with a sprinkling of rather tongue-in-cheek headings, he ultimately concluded that there was no legislative burden to justify the application of Roach when the plaintiffs effectively disqualified themselves by their own conduct. He adopted a distinctly originalist angle. He even, well, an angle which he described as garnering as much approbation as the man who asked for a double whiskey in the grand pump room at Bath. And like Justice Hayne, he felt like the plaintiffs had really failed to frame their arguments logically and consistently. Justice Hayne was unconvinced by the plaintiff's continual reference to the previous 7-day period and the tendency in the submissions to assume that this was constitutionally required. His Honour was also undisposed to accept that the curtailment was of such to unreasonably take away the opportunity to enrol when this assumed that there was a need for an extended period and overlooked the legislative requirement that existed to enrol in the first place.